Hello and welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast, your source for tech policy rants and raves from Tech Freedom, your Washington, D.C. advocate for the freedom to tinker and innovate both here on Earth and in space. I'm Aaron Soka, and I'm interviewing Jim Dunstan, veteran space lawyer of 33 years, in our third interview about space law. Jim is an adjunct fellow here at Tech Freedom, founder of Mobius Legal Group, and a pioneer in space law. Jim, thanks for coming back.
Great to be back, Baron.
So in our first episode, we talked about the basics of space law. In the last episode, we talked about space property rights and the legislation that Congress passed last year, trying to relate that back to the Outer Space Treaty, to fundamental principles of space law, and trying to understand what was right about that legislation and maybe what wasn't right, what might need to be fixed, but also what Congress didn't do in that legislation. So let's pick up where we left off last time when we talked about this. You were explaining your concern that the legislation as passed by Congress might be interpreted to go beyond creating personal property rights in resources that were extracted from an asteroid, and instead could be used to create something like a territorial claim over an asteroid that somebody hadn't necessarily even landed on, something that someone had merely, quote, obtained, to use that word from the legislation, through remote sensing or through some other means. So that was one problem with the legislation. What's the fix for that?
Well, I think the fix is pretty easy, and that would be some sort of amending language that would clearly indicate that no rights whatsoever vest until minerals or something is extracted from the asteroid itself or from the lunar surface. I mean, it's an easy and quick fix. It could be done as, you know, almost a minor amendment in some other bill.
A minor amendment?
Oh, yes, it would. I noticed that you didn't mention puns at the opening, so I thought this was a punless...
No, none of those. We have space for plenty of puns today.
So space is a big place, yes.
It is. So walk me through this. So if I'm... Let's think about this, put our lawyer hats on. So if I'm a space mining company, and I'm using a satellite, let's say I put one up in orbit with a telescope, or I'm doing it even from the Earth, and I'm trying to characterize the asteroids that are out there, determine what composes them, how valuable are they, what are their orbits, where are they going to go, what would it be required for me to send a mission out to go for them, and which ones to go for. What's my legal protection when I'm doing all of that if I don't have a legislative statutory right?
Well, I think the answer to that is you use trade secret law. You basically don't tell people what you found of these asteroids. You don't blab it to the world community. Now, on an aggregated basis, you would probably want to further the human knowledge of what the asteroid belt looks like and what asteroids in general do. But if I find asteroid ABC and it's sweet, it's the one I want to go after, I probably don't want to tip my hand to anybody that that's where I want to go after. I keep that a trade secret.
And as a sidebar here, just to step out of lawyer mode for a second, who cares about these asteroids and why are they so valuable? Give us some sense of what we're talking about here.
Well, that's always a debating point is what is the value of the asteroid? I mean, some of these asteroids are made up of precious metals, platinum and things like that. And the argument is if I bring back multiple tons of platinum and I were able to somehow get it to the surface of the Earth, given the market for platinum is X dollars an ounce, that's the value of the asteroid. Of course, anybody who knows anything about economics knows that if you flood the market with something, the value of it goes down. So, those arguments are a little bit all over the place. But mainly, the value of these asteroids is what you can do with them in space. Now, be they metals to build components, or be they carbonaceous chondrites made up of carbon and water to extract the water from and use it for rocket fuel and for breathing. I've heard numbers all over the board, but it clearly could be a billion-dollar industry, if not a trillion-dollar industry.
And it's worth pointing out here, we're not just talking about stuff that's useful for jewelry. We're talking about the very basics of electronics, the components that we use today, a lot of the reason that computer chips are still as expensive as they are, although they've come down hugely in price, is those platinum group metals.
Right.
And those things on the Earth are found on asteroid impact sites. So, in fact, we're already dealing with space resources. We're just dealing with the ones that happen to be here on the Earth.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So getting back to lawyer mode. So, I have this trade secret law that protects me. I require my private employees to sign non-disclosure agreements. But the legal issue is, if I'm going to send a mission out, what's the next thing I do once I'm ready to do it? Who do I go to?
Well, that's the big hole in this that we'll get to for a moment. But assuming that that regimen was in place that allowed me to go out and do it, which it isn't, I would have to apply for authority to do that, presumably years in advance. And presumably, I'm going to have to tell whoever is going to say yay or nay to me going where I'm going. And at that point, unless somehow we make that a confidential filing, the rest of the public, the rest of the world is going to find out that, boy, they're going to asteroid ABC, that it must be cool. So now the race is on. I'm going to try to get the ABC first.
And who are those filings made with?
Well, that's the point. There isn't anybody to technically file with, in theory, and that's where the big hole is. But before we get there, we have to sort of dive into one area of the Outer Space Treaty we haven't touched, and that's Article 6. And Article 6 of the Outer Space Treaty requires that states both authorize and continually supervise the activity of their private companies and private people to make sure that they comply with the Outer Space Treaty. And so, but right now we don't have any agency. We don't have a United States Space Agency. We don't, some people out there would say, well, gee, just go to NASA, right? Well, guess what? NASA isn't a regulatory agency. It's a scientific.
Well, thank God for that.
Well, yes, I agree with you completely. Whereas many people still do think space equals NASA and that somehow NASA has authority over this stuff. They don't. The only group that currently has any authority is within the FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, Department of Transportation, what's known as the Office of Commercial Space. They grant licenses for both launch vehicles and for payloads that are to go on launch vehicles for both the launch portion of the mission and and the reentry portion. But that's where their statutory jurisdiction ends. It's launch and landing. There is no what we refer to as on-orbit jurisdiction. Nobody has jurisdiction over the activities on orbit.
And orbit here means not just Earth orbit, right, but anything that happens in space, because anywhere you are in space, you're in some kind of orbital trajectory.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So then that's a hole, right? So what's going to happen when a private space company that maybe thinks that they've got what they need from this legislation, when they go to the FAA for a launch license to do their mission, what happens?
Well, the FAA has said that they wish to, and I'm using my little quotey fingers here, they wish to leverage that statutory authority to also authorize payloads and authorize activities in space. One, I think as a overall policy, granting any agency the ability to leverage its jurisdiction, to expand its jurisdiction.
Into the heavens.
Into the heavens.
Quite literally without limit.
Is a bad idea, generally speaking. But specifically, it's a really bad idea here because the reason FAA was granted that jurisdiction for launch and reentry was to protect the uninvolved third party. So, in other words, before you get a launch license from the FAA, you've got to prove to them that, barring an accident, you're not going to blow up your rocket and blow up people next door. You're not going to land it on somebody's cow out there. And there are all sorts of mechanisms, all sorts of equations the FAA goes through. But how are they going to determine whether or not your activity on the moon or on the asteroid, one, that activity certainly isn't going to negatively impact a third party unless you're planning on bringing a really large asteroid back and bring it into close proximity to the Earth.
Or hitting your least favorite city. Exactly.
Think Armageddon here.
I was thinking Cincinnati.
So it's, so if the FAA jurisdiction and mandate is to protect the uninvolved third party, then essentially anything would go. They would say yes, because if I'm going to go mine that asteroid, as long as I can demonstrate it's not going to come and fall on Cincinnati or any other city, then it seems to me the answer would have to be yes. And yet, that's not what the answer is going to be, because there's this larger Article 6 component that somebody is going to have a say in. Now, that somebody right now is the United States State Department. And so any launch license that FAA grants goes through the State Department. But now you're going into a very deep, deep, dark hole, you know, that no one knows what's down there.
At the bottom of which is Hillary Clinton's email server.
Right, most probably. And maybe, you know, that's the answer, is we just launch that to an asteroid and it'll solve all this. But you get my point here. There really isn't a there, because there isn't a clear mechanism for the State Department to say yay or nay.
Well, let's go back to your quotey fingers. You were referring to the FAA's use of the word leverage. They issued a letter via another process they have. They issue launch licenses, and they can also do these payload review determination letters. They issued one of those to Bigelow Aerospace, essentially saying, we don't have a problem with your plans to build a base on the moon, a private commercial base, and we would actually, in some sense, be supportive of your having non-interference rights around that base, just as we, the FAA, when we issue launch licenses, we draw similar lines around the International Space Station to make sure that other private parties don't get too close with their satellites. So that's the leveraging you're talking about. The FAA's already done this. It's not a hypothetical thing. They're trying to extend their current model for regulating launch and activities that might go near the International Space Station to creating territorial exclusion zones around private bases on the moon. Number one, that zone that they draw around the International Space Station is what, 200
200 kilometers, yeah. Mm-hmm. In all directions, yeah.
So if you use that approach on the moon, doesn't that start to look like territorial appropriation that's banned by Article 2?
I think you get very close to that. But you have to understand that the reason, ostensibly, there's a 200-kilometer exclusion zone around ISS is the fact that, you know, ISS is zipping around the Earth at 17,500 miles an hour. And so, you know, it traverses 200 kilometers of space in a matter of seconds. Whereas if you're talking about something that's sitting stationary on the moon, it's not zipping around the moon. So presumably you need a lot lower exclusion zone on the moon.
And as you said last time, the right way to deal with this is a fact-based inquiry. And it might look at things like, how much dust does your launch vehicle turn up when it lands or when it takes off? So we did talk about that as a policy matter last time, but as a legal matter, this doesn't sound like a firm basis for a Bigelow Aerospace or another private company to know that they actually have some kind of clear non-interference rights around their operations.
Absolutely. It's not like Bigelow walked away from that process with a certificate from the FAA that says you are hereby authorized to go, you know, to go do it. What they got was essentially a promise from the FAA, and the State Department is mentioned in that letter to Bigelow, by the way. You know, they say that they're going to work with Bigelow and the State Department to figure out a way to grant Bigelow, you know, a right, you know, to do this.
And how long has the State Department been working on that?
Well, let's see. Sputnik was launched in November of 1957. Probably 2 days after that, they started on. It's been
a long time coming.
It's been a long time coming, and the State Department swears that it's very close to coming out with something that's going to give us more guidance on this.
So I just want to make sure our listeners are able to keep up here. So first complaint was the bill uses the vague verb obtain rather than clearly specifying that you have to physically extract resources before you can claim personal property rights in them. Second complaint here is the bill, which of course was driven by this perceived need to clear regulatory or legal uncertainty so that private companies could raise money, it doesn't actually address the underlying core legal issue of this Article 6 question. So what's to stop the State Department when someone goes to finally get a launch license and the FAA goes to the State Department, as they're required to do, and says, does this satisfy the international obligations of the United States? What's to stop the State Department from saying, yeah, no, not really. Congress needs to pass something here that actually addresses our Article 6 responsibility.
Well, I think the practical danger for a company that wants to do this is an even worse case scenario, and that is they file their payload authorization with the FAA, and crickets ensue. There's dead silence, and there's more dead silence, and there's more dead silence. You're now down that rabbit hole in the State Department, and there isn't a way that you can rappel down in there and even find out what's going on. I mean, this is somewhat akin to the ITAR, you know, licensing. That goes over to the State Department.
Those export controls.
The export controls.
Space technologies.
Space technologies. They often go over to the State Department, and they go over to the Department of Defense, and you hear nothing for great periods of time.
Yeah, in our first interview, you mentioned you were the lawyer for Mir Corp, the private company that was going to take over operations of the Mir space station. NASA at the time was opposed to that for political reasons, for ideological reasons. They didn't want competition from a private company. And they used that process to essentially kill Mir Corp because the State Department had to go to NASA and get NASA's consent to sign off on something. Here, the FAA would have to, even if they really wanted to encourage private space, they'd have to get a sign-off from the State Department, and maybe also NASA would have a role here. So wouldn't that open the door to private companies being screwed, essentially, by politicians or governments who had some agenda against them?
You sure get into the area of picking winners and losers, don't you? I mean, and now, so now what's my recourse as that as a private entity? Now I call up my senator or congressman. Now we're clearly in politics land because you know, I've got a government bureaucracy that's just not moving, that's just not acting on it. So now my senator writes a letter to the State Department. You know, we're in full-blown politics mode. We're in what Washington does best and worst at the same time, which is not the best regime. But now let's you know back off a step here. Yeah, it's not an optimal situation for the private company because you're going to be delayed, time value of money and all that. But now let's take a look at it from the external standpoint. Is the international community going to recognize a situation in the United States where there isn't clear Article 6 compliance? In other words, if someone does go out and gets authority, brings back a piece of an asteroid, tries to sell it on the open market, is it going to get embargoed by some countries because the United States failed its Article 6 responsibilities and therefore you don't have a valid claim to that? I mean, the uncertainty starts going exponential because of the holes in this legislation.
And yet Congress had to rush to pass this bill that didn't actually solve the problems that these private companies are going to face.
That's right. That's right.
Well, sounds pretty short-sighted to me. Let's go through a lightning round here. A bunch of other questions about the bill. Does it cover all space resources?
We ended up with asteroids only, right? we went back and forth so many times. Yeah, so it's asteroids only.
And what's an asteroid? You've mentioned several times that the most valuable resources here may in fact be water and oxygen. Aren't those found on comets?
Those are really found on comets, yes.
So if I'm going to mine a comet, do I get legal protection here?
From the words of the statute, no.
Huh. Okay. We've covered the Article 6 issue. What about non-interference? The original version of this bill that was passed by the House had a system for dealing with non-interference rights. That didn't make it into the final bill. So all that really is granted by this bill is the personal property right in an object that has been, quote, obtained.
Mm-hmm.
So where does that leave a private company that might be worried that someone else might interfere with their operations on an asteroid or maybe even in the future operations on the moon?
I think it leaves them in a position of having to make the argument that they've obtained some sort of right in an asteroid by obtaining information about the right. That's the only protection they have left because of the fact that the rest of the bill has so many holes in it.
So the fact that the bill was more narrow, that it didn't cover non-interference rights in some ways, puts pressure to expand the meaning of obtain into essentially a de facto mining claim system.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Because that's your only way of protecting it.
So what about mining claims? I mean, it doesn't sound like a bad idea to me. I could certainly see a good argument that if I'm going to spend a lot of money trying to characterize an asteroid, that I should have exclusive rights in that asteroid and the ability to go out and use it. And you mentioned, for example, that it might be better for society to publish that information, especially because all that work that's done characterizing asteroids might be helpful in spotting some asteroids that could hit the Earth. So how do we create a system that gives people an incentive to make information public without worrying they're going to be giving up their core investment in the category or the catalog of asteroids that they've surveyed?
That's a tough policy question that needs to be explored. And Congress really needs to explore it. Frankly, Congress needs to call in some experts who aren't you and I, who aren't even space lawyers. They need to call in sort of mining experts, people who know about mining patents and things like that, just to explain how they work, how what's good, what's bad. For one thing, the time frames of this are going to be very, very difficult. If I'm talking about going out and getting an asteroid, for one thing, chances are the transit time out to that asteroid is not going to be weeks or months. It's going to be many months up to a year to get there. And so it's going to be difficult to craft a system that has enough time built into it that you have those rights and you're able to exercise on them, but not so long as to make them perpetual. And that's going to be a very difficult policy choice to make.
So the point here is that today Congress has essentially created a kind of de facto mining claim system, both because the word obtain is very unclear and because the FAA is off on this effort to expand its authority, and they really can use their payload review process and their launch licensing process to decide who gets to go mine an asteroid. So what I'm hearing you say, and I've always thought this, is we could have a mining claim system that doesn't violate the Outer Space Treaty, but it has to be time limited. It has to specify what you do to get certain rights, how long you have them, what you have to do to perfect them, or otherwise you lose them. Is that fair?
I think that's very fair. But there's tough trades you got to make in doing that analysis.
Okay, now someone might say in defending this bill that this bill only covers domestic to domestic interaction. That is, it only issues rights to U.S. companies enforceable in U.S. courts, and it doesn't pretend or purport to create rights that can be exercised over foreign companies. So if that's true, what's the international law problem here?
Well, I think the international law problem is, how do you alienate those assets that come back? I mean, does this essentially...
You mean sell.
It means sell, exactly. Does that mean that I'm only protected if I sell, you know, that platinum to a United States entity? Either on Earth or in orbit? I mean, does this statute preclude me from cutting a deal with the European Space Agency to provide water, you know, to a lunar base, because ESA would be able to just then take the water and say, we're not transferring that money because you don't have a valid claim to that water? I mean, you know, space is very much an international domain, and just handling things at the domestic level, I think, means you have a very limited market.
And what happens then if we're talking about a European company setting up operations next to an American company or a Chinese company that, let's say, might get to Shackleton Crater first? You talked about that being really the potential chokehold over all that ice resource at the South Pole of the Moon. Then what do we do? And does this bill help us?
I think in some respects it ties the hands of the State Department and international diplomats of trying to talk sense into China. Because China can turn around and say, look what you Americans did. You have such a bad, you know, how can you say that your domestic legislation does the right thing? We've taken a completely different tact, and therefore you don't have to recognize our claims and we're not recognizing your claims. And then we got the Wild West.
Yeah, that's certainly a core theme that we hit on here every time we can, the extent to which things that are done here in the United States that presume a certain rule of law will inevitably be twisted by foreign governments. It's certainly not hard to imagine a Chinese company setting up operations, claiming that they need some large exclusion zone around their base, and then using that to essentially stop the U.S. or European companies from really being able to get a toehold on the moon, which is what the Outer Space Treaty was supposed to stop in the first place. That, to me, is the whole point of Article 2, that you can have private activity in space, you can have private companies using resources without having essentially commercial wars between nation states, let alone real wars.
Exactly.
Well, any other suggestions for Congress as they consider revisiting this?
I think what they really need to do is they need to hold hearings, maybe some oversight hearings, of the FAA, or somehow we need to get a dialogue going in Washington, D.C. about these issues with the ultimate goal of creating a regulatory regime that meets Article 6 so that I can go somewhere, and hopefully only one somewhere within the federal government, and get a nice little sheet of paper that says, I am authorized to go to asteroid ABC. And once I have that, I know that when I get to asteroid ABC, there isn't going to be another U.S. entity sitting there. And hopefully, if we do it right, and we do it in a way that makes sense for both us and on an international side, then we get other foreign countries adopting similar domestic legislations. And then we can start talking reciprocity. We can start talking about recognizing their claims and them recognizing ours.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that. I always remind people that we already went through this. You mentioned on our previous show, the Law of the Sea Treaty was very parallel to the Moon Treaty. They were both principled resting upon the common heritage of mankind concept. They envisioned that commercial exploitation would be done, if at all, through an international entity where the profits would be shared. Well, the U.S. didn't buy that, and Democrats like John Brough in the U.S. Senate back in the late 1970s actually wrote into U.S. law, which is still there, the Deep Seabed Hard Mineral Resources Act, which was an alternative to the Law of the Sea Treaty's resource appropriation provisions that did exactly what you just mentioned. They set up a system for licensing U.S. companies through a mining claim, but also recognizing other states' legislation as interlocking states so that we would, in fact, have reciprocity. So a U.S. company and a German company wouldn't come into conflict. We would only issue licenses for a single piece of the deep seabed floor to a single company, and they'd have a limited time to use it, and they didn't use it, they'd lose it. That seems to me to be a pretty good model. I hope we're going to see Congress revisit all of this and also exercise a little more oversight of the FAA.
So one more thing, and listening to us talking back and forth, I mean, we're sounding like we want regulations, and obviously we both come from a mindset of limiting regulations and limiting the strong arm of the government. And in fact, any regime we adopt needs to have as light a touch, regulatory touch, as we can. I mean, one of the big fears we have now, and I've alluded to, is this rabbit hole at the State Department. And if a licensing to do mining in space regime evolves into anything that's close to the ITAR regime, then we failed. We've done it very, very wrong, because there are just too many blank spots, too many secrets going on. And so, yes, we need regulation because we have this international obligation, but on the same token, we can't strangle the industry.
So in terms of our hierarchy of options, the worst case scenario is a total black box where you can't get a yes. The next best thing is a mother may I regime where you have heavy-handed regulation, where you could potentially get a yes, but you probably won't, but at least you know who to ask. You and I are talking about a better approach where you set the presumption, as it is usually placed in American law, as being that you can go out and do stuff just as you can on the internet. We talk about this all the time here at Tech Freedom, that the reason the internet has flourished is that Congress took a hands-off approach back in 1996 in the Telecommunications Act. Congress said that it shall be the policy of the United States government that the internet shall remain unfettered from state and local regulation, and that in general we should take a hands-off approach. That's worked on the internet. That could work in space. But we do have these international treaty obligations. We do need ways of satisfying them. And we do need to make sure that private property is protected. And that requires having basic functioning rights over personal property, the stuff you put up into space, we already have, the stuff you take back from space. That's what Congress tried to do last year. But also that non-interference right over your ongoing operations and some sensible way of dealing with mining claims. So I'm hopeful, but also a little skeptical this is going to happen anytime soon. We're not going to have the political impetus of the last push for the Commercial Space Act. Here, these things are going to have to get fixed on their own, and it's going to require a champion on the Hill. How long do you think it might take?
I think it could be quite some time, because you're absolutely right. The parties that were pushing so hard for this legislation think they got what they needed in this, and probably got what they needed in terms of going out for another round of financing, to raise money to do this. But when they're ready to sign that contract to build that that vehicle to go out, they're going to have to, you know, come to the realization that they really don't have a right to go out and do it. And by that time, you know, in their timeline, they may be so far along the lines that it's either going to have to be a rush job back to Congress, you know, or they're going to try to do some sort of end around on this.
Well, this is just a great way to wrap up. Yeah. It's a great example of what we talk about at Tech Freedom, the freedom to tinker, innovate, and invest. All of those things here are at stake if Congress doesn't grant permission clearly in statute in advance. It's going to be hard for any of these companies to make their long-term plans. Jim Dunston, thanks for coming on. I look forward to having you back to talk about more space law topics.
My pleasure, as always.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.